Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Good morning, and thank you very much, first of all, for inviting me to address you, and thank you for your kind words. And really, I'm very honored to be with you today. I have been wondering what to tell you, what would you want to know about Egypt or our part of the world. And I decided I will quickly give you a few words about the subject, and then we probably open the floor for whatever questions you have, because I really don't want you to be disappointed after coming today, missing on the autopsy and sitting to listen to what boring speech I will give you. But just to comment on what you have said when you were introducing me, it is true, I went to school in Chapel Hill. And these were my formative years. I had just graduated from college, joined the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and then was appointed in New York as part of our mission to the UN and got my scholarship. And it was really the first time I leave Egypt, leave my family, and I had a great time. 2 years in Chapel Hill. It really... you know, was part of my formation very, very early in my life. It was a very difficult time. It was early 70s when we had no diplomatic relations, and, you know, people, when they met me in the street and they asked me, where are you from, and I say, from Egypt, they say, ah, oh, you're from Egypt. When I went to the dorm and the girls on the floor, they knew a girl was coming from Egypt. They said, oh, they expected someone to come riding a camel or, you know, and some of them, they said, oh, you're even dressed like us. So this human interaction is really very important. And I want to tell you that the people in Egypt, they value very much the American culture, the American traditions, and what it stands for. And even in the hardest of times, you find that the human interaction at the people's level very strong and very lively. And I want to say that we must always put this as a priority, the interaction between people, and we should not be looking at the political formal or official relationship, because this is, it's not always scratching the real life. I, you know, as a diplomat, I feel I'm treading hot water when I say this, and I might not be saying the right thing, but this is how I feel, that we must focus on people. The last 7 years, I have been working with people, with the most vulnerable, marginalized people. And it was a big shift for me all my life. I was a career diplomat. I, you know, returned from South Africa to be Assistant Minister for Foreign Affairs. And then I was put in this position. And while in this position, I was a candidate for a Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. And just before swearing in, I was told, no, you cannot leave this position. You have to stay on. I cannot tell you how disappointed I was. Not because I don't like my current position, but being trained all your life as a diplomat, I thought that this would be the crowning of my career. But honestly, what we are doing now is the real thing. I know that people now are very concerned with democracy, good governance, rule of law, respect for human rights. And I want to tell you that sometimes we talk about it without going deeper to see how people perceive these values. And how people, not only how people perceive these values, but how people are prepared, are socialized into becoming free citizens, citizens who feel committed to their society, citizens who feel that they must have the information about any issue at stake in order for them to make informed views. Not much attention has been given to this. Also, the role of women or the status of women. I know that there is a lot of talk about the status of women, but again, we think that when we address women when they are adults and ask them to do something, they will do it. Forgetting that unless they get the preparation as young children, they will not be able to do it. You may not feel this, but if you go to some marginalized groups of women and tell her, how do you feel about something? And then she expresses her views, and then you tell her, why didn't you speak up? She probably will not give you an answer because she was not brought up to speak up or to... not only to express her views, but to ask for the information that will enable her to make her views and to be given the freedom of association that will give her even stronger position when she's making her views. And this is what I want to talk about today. You've talked about the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Egypt or the Egyptian diplomacy. And I'm really proud to be part of this school. It's a very good school, and I hope it will keep this because we're going through a very hard time. I mean, so many things are at stake now. This school provides you with very good education. When I joined early 70s, there was huge discrimination against women within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I had graduated the valedictorian from my college or university, as we call it, and then I was supposed to be appointed on the faculty, and because number one and number two were girls, we were not appointed. They said, no, we cannot have two faculty members girls. When we went to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they took the top 10. They said, you have to sit for a competition. We sat for the competition. We passed the exam, and then they said, no, you cannot be transferred abroad, because as an Egyptian girl, how will you live alone if you are single? Our traditions will not allow you, and if you are married, your husband will not allow you. Nowadays, after we fought, and I was part of the group that really fought hard with the opinion leaders in Egypt, like leading journalists. I remember we went and we met with Hassanin Haykel. And Hassanin Haykel, he was the editor-in-chief of Al Ahram for a long time. He challenged me personally. We were four or five people, went Egyptian diplomats. And then he said, do you compare yourself to Nabil Al Arabi? You remember Nabil Al Arabi? And then I said, why do I have to compare myself to Nabil Al Arabi? He said, because you want to be on equal footing with him. I said, give me the opportunity. I may prove to be equal to Nabil Al-Arabi, if not better than him. So we started having girls go out posted, but with a different poster. Now I can say that there is absolutely no discrimination within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs against women. Absolutely none whatsoever. But we had to fight to get it. What I wanted to say is that many women do not know how to fight. Many men also do not know how to fight. And usually there is a correlation between poverty and, you know, the ability to express your views and the ability to be able to influence others who have different values or different opinions than your views. What I wanted to talk to you about from what we are doing now is empowering women. I'm sure many of you who have visited Egypt or read about Egypt, you know that Egyptian women throughout our history played a very prominent role. during the pharaohs. Hatshepsut was a commander in chief. She led the army, and Shabarat Ad-Dur was a very strong woman during the Islamic one of our Islamic periods. And now we have many, you know, ministers, judges. Recently we had a big debate about women judges, but we have now 31 women judges who are young, and they are receiving the proper training. And I really prefer that they are trained as judges rather than you bring someone who is not trained well and you put her here. This will harm the perception of women who can deliver. You must prepare them for the position in order for them to compete, because I'm against giving favors to anyone. Like we when we talk about representation in the parliament, some people say put a quota. If I put a quota, and I'm not against the quota as a short-term measure of affirmative action, but unless women have fought to get a position, they will not keep it and they will not achieve. So what I want to talk about here is the girl. Not much attention has been given to the girl child. What I'm going to talk about now is not the mainstream, not what you see in the street when you walk in Cairo, but I'm talking about the marginalized, and they are a minority, but they are not a small number. They are big in numbers. Those girls who are either pushed into a certain kind of education to be prepared for a certain role in life, or they are prevented altogether from going to school. We have in Egypt started what we say a societal movement to raise awareness of the value of the girl child, because among certain classes, they don't see, I mean, the only role they see for the girl is to get married and have children. And meanwhile, she can do anything, probably teach her how to cook so that she will make a good wife. She has to be very obedient, not to raise her voice, and not to do anything that will harm the honor of the family till she's moved to another male who will look after her. So she's transferred from the father to the husband. We have started this movement to raise the awareness of the society of the value of having a girl child, and to instill confidence in the girl child of what she can do, her contribution to the society. This movement was declared in 2001, and we were addressing the pockets in certain remote areas where girls were really discriminated against. Within this movement, we had two programs going. One is called Girls Education. And when we talk about girls education, I'm not talking about just going to school, but I'm talking about making a school that caters for the needs of the girl child. A school that will keep the girl inside the school against all the pressures to take her out of the school. And there was an initiative, or it's still an initiative, by the UN Secretary General called Girls Education. We have really done very well to mobilize the local community to the value of the girl, to the value of sending the girl to school, and the benefit that the family will get from sending the girl to school. We ended up by the families who were originally against sending the girl to school donating the land where we built the school. And the community that was against the education of the girl became the custodian or the trustees that ensured that the school will be in the best form and the teacher will continue to be at the highest level of training, and ensured also a poverty alleviation program, because in a climate like this, usually the family will look and see, well, if I send the girl to work, she will bring money home. But if I send her to school, I have to pay for her. And why do I pay for her? I mean, she's not going to work. After all, she's going to get married. So I'm not going to send her to school. So we started a program of poverty alleviation, giving clothes, feeding, not only for the girl, but to take home for the family. And in less than 3 years, we have built more than 660 schools. And the quality of these schools is the active learning approach. It encourages the girl to seek information. It encourages the girl to speak about her problems. Like, they found out that many, many times the girl will come home in the morning very unhappy, and she will not talk. So they have this small complaint box, and they said, whoever has a complaint, you can put a small note. And we have an hour during the day, and we discuss the problems. Most of the time, it was girls complaining that the mother wanted her to stay home to clean the house or look after her siblings or go help her father in the field. And through the discussion in the classroom, they were able to solve the problem either by going to the mother, explaining to her, or moving the time when the school starts to accommodate the girl. And this flexibility is really the strength, because in Egypt we have a problem of school dropout. Like, if you ask the Minister of Education, he will tell you school enrollment is 98% or 99%. He's right, 99%. But how many are retained and how many drop out, this is usually not looked after. We're proud that in these schools, girls do not drop out, because the school is very sensitive for the problems of the girl. It's also, you know, laying the foundation for democracy. When you tell the girl that she has the right to speak and she has the right to be heard, and whenever anyone is deciding on a matter that touches on her life, she must be consulted and her views must take a primary consideration, or must enjoy primary consideration when making the decision. This is quickly one program. The other program is, I don't know if you've heard about female genital mutilation. This is a practice that exists in some parts of Egypt, mostly Upper Egypt, mostly in remote areas. And this has been, this is an issue that was treated by great sensitivity, and it's a taboo, nobody should talk about it. What happens inside the house, nobody should talk about it. We in the National Council for Childhood and Motherhood decided to deal head on with this issue. We built on the work that was done by a number of NGOs, but it was sporadic and low profile. So we came very strongly against it, and we started a program of the declaration of FGM-free villages. And the objective was to create pressure groups that will support opponents of this practice. Because before that, nobody could speak loudly against it, even though many people in Egypt don't know about this practice. I myself, till I joined NCCM in end of 1999, I didn't know that we have a problem like this in Egypt. I have not seen anyone, neither in my family, friends, schools, whatever, who was subjected to this practice. My mother is not, my grandmother is not, and my mother does not know anyone who has had it. Yet, on the other hand, you have people who believe in it. They do it as a religion. So it was, but it was practiced silently. Nobody was talking about it. We came very strongly, and we owe it to Mrs. Mubarak, who stood up and said that FGM is closely related with women empowerment. It is a practice that is detrimental to the well-being of the woman, to her freedom of speech, freedom of decision making. Nowadays, the media discusses this issue very openly. Nowadays, I go from one village to the other in Upper Egypt celebrating the declaration of FGM-free villages. And you can say that we have managed to change the views of many families about this practice. We were faced by the opposition from the league, from the religious institution, and from the medical institution, because strangely enough, in Egypt, it's mostly practiced by doctors, while in other African countries, it's practiced by, you know, midwives or non-professional staff. So we have managed to move the medical practice against it because it's not taught in the School of Medicine and it's not part of the curriculum. And we have finished a legal amendment to the child's law whereby we criminalize FGM or criminalize even instigating to do the practice. So quickly, these are two programs that we are doing to encourage the girl child in the marginalized parts of Egypt to, you know, we consider these as serious forms of discrimination and violence against the girl child. And really, we have managed to do this very well. We have a program on adolescents' health as well. And again, this was a taboo. We should not talk about adolescents' health. Children didn't know how they can contract HIV and AIDS. And even though the prevalence of HIV and AIDS in Egypt is very, very low, because it's a very conservative society, but we are afraid that the infection rate will be high because children or adolescents don't know how they can contract the disease. Same for virus C, which is really a challenge in Egypt, hepatitis C. So the adolescents' health program is going very well. Same with the drugs problem. We have a you know, probably if you look at Egypt from an international point of view, it is not a problem area. We do not feature as one of the countries that have a problem, but we do have a problem. And the problem is that drugs now is targeting school adolescents. Previously, it was truck drivers with hashish, but now it's the most dangerous forms of drugs and targeting the adolescents. We started this program, which again is using the kids as a tool to say no to drugs. And we train them on conflict resolution, how to express their views, and if they have disagreement or an argument with the parents, how to get through to their parents, how to convince others. And that if you have a problem, there isn't one solution to the problem, there are many solutions. So quickly, we are adopting a human rights approach, and the right to participate is our tool to do whatever we want to do. Of course, the media is a very important factor because you're changing attitude. You're changing practices that continued for a number of years. And it was difficult at the beginning to get the support of the media on certain issues like FGM. I remember the first meeting we had on this issue, we had asked for the media to come and cover. And then as we proceeded, I discovered that there was a camera without a cameraman. And I said, where is the cameraman? And then I was told he didn't like the discussion and he decided he's not going to cover it. And he walked out. Another problem is that some media people were enthusiastic about the issue of FGM and they said, we want to have talk shows. And then they were very disappointed at the end when the debate turned out against what they had originally intended. So we told them, let's cooperate together, let's choose the people. If we want to combat FGM, we must have very strong speakers who can convey the message and who can convey a message that will hit the hearts and minds of people and will stick. And we should refrain from sending any controversial issues. It was very difficult with the religious people. The Muslims thought that Prophet Muhammad and Islam called for FGM, and Christians thought that Jesus called for it. And then we discovered together that it's practiced by Muslims, by Christians, by Jews, by non-believers in this central part of the African continent. So it is an African tradition, not an Islamic or Christian or whatsoever. And of course, we did this in international partnership. We don't work alone. We work with, like with FGM, we started with some Italian NGOs, because I'm sure you're well aware now that many European countries have cases before their courts on FGM. Some of its citizens are accusing the state of not protecting the girls against this practice. While what happens is that in the holidays, the father takes the girl back home and she has the practice done to her, and then when she returns and tells her mother, the mother faints and she goes to court. And you know, so we're working in cooperation with other countries who are suffering from the practice, and I think we have made a breakthrough. Another issue that we're working on is child labor and street children. And again, child labor is a problem, because in a poverty atmosphere, they use the child as a tool to alleviate poverty. They don't see it as a violation of the rights of the child. They say education has no value. So why? Because graduates from college are unemployed. While if I take my son to any auto shop, he will be hired immediately. Why is he hired immediately? Because he's underpaid, no medical cover, no social cover, no protection, none whatsoever. And it's easy. I mean, he can be easily manipulated and exploited. So we have a very strong program now, because we feel that every child has the right to go to school, every child has the right to enjoy his or her childhood and should not be deprived of this for any reason. Street children is another area that, again, we are working hard on, but poverty alleviation is very important, and raising the awareness of the exploitation of the child in the street. Because some parents think that they can send their children to beg on the road and he will come home or she will come home as intact as when she left home. So we try to explain to them, no, this is not what happened. In closing, I want to tell you that as signatories to both the convention, actually Egypt signed all conventions on human rights of the UN, the seven treaty of human rights, the rights of the child, elimination of discrimination against women, rights of migrant workers, social, economic, and cultural rights, civil and political rights, against racial discrimination, and against torture. We signed all these agreements, and we take our commitments seriously, and we try to implement it, but again, not everyone has the same conviction, and you have to start by raising the awareness in order to move forward. Another area that I want to touch on quickly, trafficking. This has been an issue now that the United States is very actively involved. The First Lady of Egypt, Suzanne Mubarak, has formed a peace movement. And the peace movement, or Women for Peace, the Suzanne Mubarak International Women for Peace movement, has taken it upon itself to deal with the trafficking issue, not only at the national level, but at the international level as well. And we are engaged right now in a dialogue about this, because I'm sure you are aware that through Sinai, some young ladies from Eastern Europe are being trafficked to Israel, and this is a big debate. Of course, this is done by Bedouins, and the government is trying to track it down any one of you following the situation now. In Egypt, we have a certain situation in Sinai because there were some attempts, some terrorist acts that happened to people in Sharm el-Sheikh. And there is some tension right now with the Bedouins. But anyway, some of the Bedouins, I must say not all the Bedouins, but this is an issue that we are working on. What concerns me now is classifying child labor and early marriage as trafficking. Working against a cultural background that I have just explained concerning child labor and concerning the girl child, I find it, I don't know how to say this, it's not encouraging a solution. It's very important to work on raising awareness that the girl should not marry before a certain age, that it is not in the best interest of the girl or the family to make her marry early. We have introduced legislation to the parliament criminalizing trafficking in children, criminalizing marrying before the age of 18, which is the definition of a child. Currently, minimum age of marriage for the boy is 18 and the girl 16. So we have raised the girl to become 18. Having said this, I want to tell you that the average minimum age of marriage in Egypt is rising very, very, very high. People are complaining that girls do not get married till they are 35 or even more. So we still have this situation where some families make their girls marry at 15 or 16. They don't register them at birth, and then they bring a professional to make an estimation of the age, and she gets married. And other women who do not marry even at 35. But again, if we're talking about human rights, every child counts. And if we have one child who marries at the age of 14 or 15, we must stop this. I think I will stop here, and I will take any questions you may have, because I'm... Yes, please.
I'm Cheryl Donovan. We're here in the International Institute Conference in July. But the question I have is with regard to your work on women's rights.
Yes.
We have found, some of us who felt like we worked hard for women's rights have been frustrated because we feel like the younger generation doesn't understand the necessity for working for women's rights. With the exception of perhaps some reproductive issues, they don't really get excited about working for women's rights. And I was just curious if y'all had a similar problem in Egypt. And y'all, by the way, means you all.
I know. I was in North Carolina. I know y'all. I know it very well. Well, thank you for this. We have exactly the same situation. We are fighting to send girls to school. Yet you go to the higher classes in the society, girls with the best education, they opt to stay home. They say, no, I don't want to work. I want to get married, have children, and I don't want to work. And that's why I started really my talk by saying we talk about democracy, participation, yet we don't know how the targeted groups perceive participation, perceive empowerment. I think it's a waste for the entire community that someone so qualified deprives the society of her capabilities and stays home. But at the end of the day, she has the right to choose. Most of them, what I have seen, after 10 years staying at home, they want to go back and work. But then they are not at a competitive edge with similar girls who did not stay home for 10 years. My daughter, for instance, she had her second child, and then she said, Mom, it's too much. I think I want to stay home. I told her, you will regret it. I'm happy to help you to continue, because I was in the similar situation when I had my son, and I told my mother, I cannot cope. She told me, we'll help you. So my mother, my husband, and my elder sister, the three of them I remember, they said, we will support you, but don't stay home. And I didn't, and I'm glad I didn't. So I think, I know it's an American culture, and my children who were brought up in liberal education, like they say, Mom, you have to pay the price for sending us to this kind of schools. When they express a view, you have to respect it. I don't know. I think we have to work on some persuasion. We should not accept what they say, because usually they take a decision based on the situation as it stands at the moment. They don't have long-term vision. So this is a problem that we have. You know, there is not enough enthusiasm among younger generation. I don't know if I'm right if I say this. The lower income group, they are probably more motivated than the higher income group. It might be a very wide generalization, but this is my observation.
Yes.
On the UN Declaration of Rights for Children.
Yes.
Has the United States signed that?
Thank you for that.
Thank you very much for that. I didn't know how to bring it up. The entire community of nations have signed, except for two states, the United States and Somalia. Yes. Somalia did not ratify. United States signed, but did not ratify. And I think one of the problem was the capital punishment for people under 18. And I think your constitutional court has ruled against that. So we are very optimistic that the U.S. will soon ratify, especially that the U.S. has ratified the two optional protocols. The two optional protocols to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the one on the involvement of children in armed conflicts, and the second one on sale of children, child prostitution, and child pornography. So I hope that you will work on that. Wherever I go, I always mention this, because this convention really is great. I owe the work that I have done at home to being a member on the Committee on the Rights of the Child. It's a great education, it's a great yardstick, and it is very much in conformity with your culture. Everything you're doing, you don't really... I don't see any problem, except that the argument we always get is that we're not good on ratifying such instruments. That's the only reply I get.
Have you been involved in the One Room School for Egypt's Girls Initiative? Ah. Come out and built school.
Are you with Apache?
Yes.
Ah.
My sister is with
me. Oh, this is great. Yeah.
You know, and we've been out there, we've built the schools, we've seen the openings and all, but since we're not out there all the time, it's hard to get a sense of progress other than we're building more and more schools. But is it progress in the villages? Is it being a success? I think some of the schools are more successful than others. But is it working?
It is the best thing that we have done. And last week, Heather Plank had an art exhibition. This is the wife of Mr. Raymond Plank, the founder and the CEO of Apache. They were very enthusiastic about our work and decided to partner with us, and they have built 200 schools. For us, actually, Mr. Plank challenged me to give him 200 pieces of land to build the schools in 2006, and if I do that, he will build 1,000 more. So we fulfilled our promise, and we're waiting for him to build the 1,000. Anyway, it's working very good, and the success of these schools is not only the construction, but the support that we give it when we build the school. When Apache approached us, I said, we don't want you to give us the money to build the schools. We want you to build the schools, and we want you to go frequently visit these schools. So they asked to have lands, plots of land that is the closest to Cairo so that they can go and visit. And we have given them that in Cairo or Giza, maximum Fayoum, they build some schools in Minya, and they go visit very often. Maria Maher. She is an artist, and she goes visiting, and they have art. The more you visit, the more you interact with the girls, the more you help the girls to feel encouraged and motivated. So UNICEF is very impressed by the success, and they are documenting it now, and they will circulate the documentation to countries with similar problems. Yes, we do need to build more schools, because many girls are still outside schools. And this initiative, if you look at it, it's very costly. It costs a lot to build one school. It's not like regular schools where you spend less on it. Why you spend more on these? Because you build a school where the girl lives. So we build a school for 30 girls, and we train the teachers much more than you do train them for formal schools. And it is also formal education. It is, you know, the salaries are paid by the Ministry of Education, and books are given by the Ministry of Education. We use their curriculum, but the curriculum is translated into activities, again, to engage children. So it is working. It is working very well. And we hope to pull out, and these schools will be self-sustained. If we do that, then we have succeeded. But it is really working very well. Yeah. And you should, you know, Mrs. Bush went and visited them, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, the new Secretary General, many people, they go and they visit these schools, and it's very interesting to see how very poor, marginalized girls stand up and speak in all confidence. This is our success. Not as much information as they gather in their heads, but how they see themselves, how they envisage the role, their dreams. You know, you talk to her, she tells you, I want to be an ambassador, I want to be a judge, I want to be an engineer. This is really, we're changing the lives of these girls.
I'm sort of curious, from a citizen activist perspective, which track do you think is more effective? Either trying to push for internal reforms in some of these countries to outlaw FGM, etc., or to liberalize the laws in the United States and certain other Western countries to allow for more women to seek political asylum here based on gender discrimination or on gender inequality in general. I know that there are some organizations in the United States who, once the women get here, then they really push to get them residency status here long term. And I wondered, which one do you think is kind of more effective? I question whether we can change a lot of, and you know, if we have time to change a lot of laws in other countries, all the women and children who are affected, you know, in the 10 to 20 years of that.
If you're talking human rights, then you must ensure that there is no discrimination in the enjoyment of rights. You give one person asylum because this person managed to reach you and ask for asylum, and you leave many others suffering behind. So I would say push for internal reform. Push for awareness at home, and push for effective laws, and push for actual implementation of the laws. I would say that this is, from a human rights perspective, is more efficient, it's more cost-effective than just leaving the situation as it is, and then whoever manages to come and seek asylum, you give her asylum based on gender. I really have my reservations on this. If you ask me the choice, I will not go for it. And I must say that now the climate, at least, you know, judging by Egypt, everything is out in the open now. In Egypt, you can talk about anything. You can criticize any situation. We have endless number of opposition papers and numbers of opposition parties. Whether effective or not effective, it's another story, but at least you can air any problem you have. The most important thing is to be articulate in the way you put your views, how to influence the minds of people when so many are competing for the attention of this citizen. So it is very important to train them on how to put their views, how to give solid arguments, and how to give clear messages, because like FGM, nobody disagrees that this is a human rights issue. It is a gross violation of human rights. I worked very hard on this issue. And the Mufti, the Grand Mufti, I don't know if you know what's Mufti, this is the highest religious position who interprets the Sharia and the Hadith and all of that. I talked to the Mufti and I said, we need a fatwa from you that FGM is against Islam. And then I was happily surprised. He phoned me one day. Of course, he made many, many statements. He's a very liberal man. He phoned me one day and he said, I'm organizing this conference where I'm getting all religious leaders from Muslim countries to talk about mutilation of the body of the woman. And I want you to come and give a speech. I said, how many minutes you want me to talk for? And he said, as long as you want. I said, it's not done like this. I'm sure you have a time. And then he said, how many minutes you want? I said, okay, give me 10, 15. He said, okay, you can have 15, 20. I said, oh, good, 20. He said, 20, 25. Great. So I went, and here he was with the Sheikh Al-Azhar and the Minister of Waqf and other religious leaders and this German NGO, and he opened the conference with one paragraph and he closed, and then Sheikh Al-Azhar very short, and then I spoke at length. I really took my time to speak, and I sat there all day long to see the conclusions, the recommendations of the conference. I didn't want to leave before I see, because I knew it was very critical. 2 days later, there was a big article, one whole page in one of the opposition papers, and they had the picture of Al-Mufti, Sheikh Al-Azhar, and my picture, and saying that I manipulated Al-Mufti into having this conference, and they gave the wrong interpretation of everything. I said, what's this? This is not politics. We're not talking politics. We're talking human rights. So the average citizen is really at a disadvantage when someone is used to a practice that his parents, grandparents have been doing for a number of years, and now you ask them to change. They want a clear message. They want to know that there is a consensus on this message. So there is a responsibility. You have to encourage people to give the right signal and encourage internal reform and make sure that the benefit will reach the biggest number, not only one person or two people, but the biggest number. So you have to make everything debatable and encourage a consensus. And it is not easy. I tell you, it is not easy, because some people can really manipulate facts. And you know, to the extent that they published in the government paper the following day a piece of news that they have changed the recommendations of the conference. I was shocked. I said, who can change a recommendation after the participants have gone home? This is illegal. It cannot be done. So I phoned the Mufti. He said, nothing happened. So here you have a government paper, and here you have an opposition paper. And who is the victim? The citizen.
Did the Mufti give you the fatwa?
He did, and I'm really grateful to him. And I cannot tell you what we're doing with this fatwa. Everywhere we propagate it, because people are very concerned now about religion. Everything you do, they say, what's the views of religion? And even if it is a practice that were not debated at the time, you still have to give them a fatwa, some way or the other. But we are still fighting.
Thank you.
Your Excellency, I wish we had more time. You are very persuasive, no doubt.
I hope so. I hope so.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.